Welcome to Placemaking, a Craftword podcast. My name is Trevor Hightower, and I'm here with my co-host, partner, and friend, Riley Kiltz.
Hey, everyone. Each month, we get to interview the leaders that are shaping the multifamily industry. We get to hear about their stories, understand their motivations, and hear more about the future that they envision for the industry.
We believe that the buildings we live in shape how we live and who we become. Through Placemaking, we get to talk to the owners, operators, and innovators who are the people shaping the buildings that shape us.
We're thrilled you're here.
This week, we're talking to Sue Vickery, a key leader in the Trammell Crow Residential team. As Managing Director of Resident Experience, Sue is responsible for the pre-development process, plan review, interior design direction, and sourcing the latest technologies and amenities for inclusion in each deal. Sue has been a friend for a few years now. It's really apparent for anyone who's worked with Sue that she has a passion for design and innovation and multifamily that leads to a better experience for residents. Sue Vickery, we're thrilled to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
So Sue, we have so much to cover with you, from your unique role in crafting resident experience for one of the largest and most notable developers, to your passion for design and innovation, to your insight of where the puck is going in the multifamily industry. Before we get there, though, we want to better understand Sue. Share with us where you grew up and how your early years shaped you.
I grew up in Bowie, Maryland, and I am the youngest of four kids, and my next oldest sister is 11 years older than me. My brother is 20 years older than me, and my sister is 22 years older than me. And I feel like that was a big part of how I was formed, because ultimately it felt like I was an only child. And by the time, you know, I kind of hit my teenage years, my dad passed away when I was 14. My mom became just very hands-off. So I was super independent. But what really shaped me is they were very traditional parents, being 42 and 45 years older than me, and from Richmond, Virginia. And so it was all about, honey, you go to college to meet your man. You go to college to meet a husband, which I failed at epically. I was not married when I graduated college. And so I never really had any career guidance at all. My two sisters never worked. And so I kind of led the charge for being a career woman. And it's been an interesting dynamic in my family as a result. But that's what really formed me, is thinking that I had to be the lady of the house and then realizing that's not so much me.
That's so fascinating. Independence took you to your first job at CWS Apartments, where you had two roles that really provide a pretty important understanding of the multifamily industry. You started as a property manager, which obviously gave you a unique understanding of building operations. And then you were promoted into acquisitions, which I'm sure you learned how to underwrite and invest in real estate as an asset class. So tell us more about how these two roles shaped you and your understanding of the multifamily industry.
So a little confession, I don't have my entire work history on my bio because I actually started out as a lease before I went to CWS, and I was with a company called Summit Properties. And essentially, I started out as a leasing person. I leased, I was an assistant manager, I became a manager, and that is what brought me to Texas. Came down, leased up a property here in Austin in 6 months, and then got courted by CWS Apartments. And so as a result of doing a rehab there for them of 600 units, they promoted me to regional. And they actually had a huge portfolio of manufactured homes, and they decided to sell that off and reinvest in apartments. So we had a lot of equity to place. And my boss at the time, Sean Breslin, who now runs asset management for AvalonBay, came to me and said, okay, here's your day of reckoning. Do you want to stay in operations or do you want to go into acquisitions? It took me 2.2 seconds to answer that. And I said, absolutely acquisitions. That was what I would call the pivotal moment in my career, because I went from property management, which frankly is a very female-driven industry, into acquisitions, which is a very male-driven industry. And so I learned about sourcing loans. I negotiated contracts. I hired and interviewed brokers. I oversaw the due diligence of all the acquisitions. I did all the research for new markets and toward new deals. And so it was really just me and Sean handling all of this. And he gave me so much autonomy. And so that was like the turning point for me in getting kind of comfortable in my own skin and more of the business negotiator person, understanding the big picture and frankly, understanding finance as well.
I cannot imagine how lucky Summit Properties was to have you as a leasing agent. That both terrifies me and impresses me. Just imagining how well you did.
I was really good at it. As you guys know, it's hard to say no to me. So my closing ratio was
I can imagine. So you joined TCR, where you've been a key leader now since 2000. You've run asset management for the Western United States. You're responsible for $1.3 billion portfolio. Can you tell us about that experience? What should people know about the role of the asset manager in the multifamily real estate portfolio as a whole, and then how, since 2000, that role has evolved for you?
When I came on board, there was no asset management within TCR. And I'm very proud to say that I was the first one. And as a result, we now have a very robust asset management platform at TCR. Originally, I started out in Houston, and we had, before we developed our resident experience role, but back in the day, we had a very blended role for TCR, meaning we drove a lot of operational decisions, many more than what a typical asset manager would drive. And that's because I think in part we're a private firm. And so I'm working for the guys who literally write the checks. And so that's very personal. And as a result, I felt a lot of personal ownership of the decisions that were being made. So like we were driving rents, we were deciding what vendors to use, especially with marketing. We drove a lot of those types of decisions versus just reviewing and analyzing reports, which is what a lot of asset management people do. And that $1.3 billion portfolio was about 24 assets. And as a result, I had to learn really quickly how to choose what's important to focus on. And so I think that helped form kind of a really big picture view. I think that the real challenge was making sure that all these assets had the right amount of attention, because we've learned that probably a better ratio of assets to asset manager is anywhere from 8 to 12 assets, depending on how many of those are lease-ups. I think that's what the challenge is when you have that big of an asset portfolio, is that everybody just needs to realize that you can only pay so much attention to so many things. And having a clear understanding of what's important to us was what ultimately enabled me to be successful. Otherwise, you know, you could just be all over the place with that number of assets under you.
Just quick follow-up question on that. So I was just having a conversation with someone about how to allocate time. How did you approach it then in shaping kind of your own resource and most precious resource of time? Just could you double click a little bit into that?
Constantly the squeaky wheel, right? It's just constantly the squeaky wheel. That's how you have to do it. Whatever is on fire at the moment, taking care of that as soon as possible, but also understanding what probably caused the fire is super helpful. If that makes sense.
It's fascinating, Sue, to hear you describe what, as you started asset management at TCR and really by necessity having to address asset concerns based on what is urgent and important, to your current role, which is unique in the industry, in our opinion, where you're able to focus on what's important but not necessarily urgent, and that's the focus on the end user. And really, as we see it, in your executive role, you are called to differentiate Trammell Crow residential assets through the quality of the resident experience, which the focus on the end user seems to be unique in our industry. How do you do this? And tell us more about this role.
So what I was just previously discussing about having so many assets and being responsible for, you know, success to a more in a more granular sense is what led to us bifurcating this role. And so now the asset management team takes over basically when we start operations. And the resident experience is now a development role. And it has to do with product design, as you know, as you mentioned here, product design, marketing, differentiation. So it really allowed myself and my counterpart, Alice Tanchel, to really run with this and do something really unique for TCR. And so what I do as far as differentiation is I look outside of multifamily. I do not find anything inside multifamily particularly inspiring. And I remember getting early on getting a lot of emails from our CEO about how this design, how this competitor or developer did something cool and that developer did something cool. And finally, one day I just answer back and I'm like, listen, here's my goal. The next thing is somebody's going to get an email about how we did something cool. Like, I want to be the one that figures out something that nobody else has ever done. And so that's extremely motivating because I'm competitive. But I go to places like Southwest Interactive Conference here in Austin because it literally is leading edge technology. Things like VR, things like chatbots, all kinds of things that are being applied to other industries that will eventually come to us, but somebody needs to drive that. So I hope that that's going to be me. And so I look at that. And I also look at where do people spend their time when they're not at home? When we're building a new deal, I like to go to that location and say, okay, for example, there's a Topgolf down the street that's super popular, or there's a particular bar and everybody goes there. So what does that mean? And so I go and I look at how people are interacting outside of their homes, and I try and bring that into our deal with the goal of people who will not want to leave where they live because it's so great.
So I'd love to hear, just because I know that we all have really great success stories of the past, and also just massive failures that we learned to come from. Can you give me just like two quick stories on, you talked about kind of micro trends, right, influencing some of the things you brought from the outside into one of the communities. Can you give an example of where that worked extremely well and you're really proud looking back, or one of those like, this is something that you brought in, but actually people want to keep that away from their home? I'm just curious to know if you have an example of either.
The first thing that I ever did, and again, this is just such a kudos to the environment in which I work, because if it wasn't for that, I would not be able to do anything. And there's a lot of trust there. The first thing that I ever did was a blow dry bar in one of our Dallas assets. And Ken still tells the story to this day. It was like, I don't know, 12 years ago, but it's still like a big thing. And lucky for me, it worked, because honestly, I think that's why I still get to do weird things now. But, you know, in Dallas, it's all about hair. And I thought, why don't we do that? Because I know that people would use that. And so we set it up, and I just want to give out a shout out, Lincoln Property Management. They figured out how to run it. They hired kind of a outside person to come in, and we gave away haircut or blowouts to residents. And it was so successful, and you'll never guess why. It was successful because guys don't like to go get their hair cut. And so it was like 80% men going down there to get their hair cut from our apartment complex, because they're, no offense, lazy. And it was just great for them to just go into the lobby and get it done. And that blow dry bar is still operating in that deal right now.
No way.
Very, very proud of that. Knock on wood, but I've never put in something that did not get used.
Yeah. That's awesome. So we're going to move on to a little bit of a design and functionality section, which I'm super excited about to dive in with you. I know from working with you that you have a passion around building design and functionality. Can you just share a little bit more about where you derive that passion from?
It's really happened organically. And I think it comes from, I love analysis and I love problem solving. And as a result, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why we haven't put anything in yet that's been a failure, because I really enjoy making a bulletproof argument as best as I can. And you guys probably have experienced that. But I think honestly, that's what it is. And finding solutions in unexpected places and just kind of constantly being on the lookout for something cool and something fresh, but something that's going to have some longevity.
Sue, this podcast is entitled Placemaking, and we are interviewing leaders who are helping making better places. And so help us understand an example of how your focus on design and functionality led to a better outcome for a specific resident. Would love to hear an on-the-ground story of resident loving a place that they live because of a thoughtful design that you helped implement.
Yeah. So here's something interesting is we started about 3 years ago doing resident surveys, and it's been fantastic for me because the residents confirmed what I was kind of communicating organically. And I don't want to say that like I'm this brilliant psychic. I think it's just more that I look in so many different places for how, what people value, that it makes a more informed opinion than if you're just looking at apartments. And so as a result, just simple things like people want tubs in their apartments. And there's a perception that people want walk-in showers. That is not true. There is a very small demographic that wants walk-in showers, but 80% of our portfolio wants a tub in their apartment. Things like that. Things like residents don't know how thick their granite is. And so if you spend a lot of money in granite, it's because that's what the developer and the equity people think will add value at sale, which it does, but the resident doesn't care and doesn't know. So it's those types of things that, as a result of our follow-up surveys, people don't complain about how many light switches they have anymore or how many USB ports they have. Instead, they say, oh my God, I love my USB ports. They stop complaining about the things that we responded to. And I think that's the most exciting thing, is having that kind of data to provide added functionality. And one of the things right now, for example, is things like private workspaces. The WeWork concept was always important, but now people want even more like enclosed little rooms because they wanted to get out of their apartments during COVID and still have some place to work remotely.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing. Looking forward, tell me about one current fad that's going on that you think 10 years from now will no longer be present.
Peloton bikes. Everybody wants a Peloton bike, and fitness in general, it mark my words, in 5 years or less, it's not going to look anything like this. It is going to be VR and remote driven. It's going to be, you know, YouTube videos. It's going to be much more, give me the equipment I need to perform this workout routine that I have on my app or whatever. So
could you see, you talked about the co-working trend and private workspaces. Could you see any, just those two trends converging at all to where, given maybe everyone's reaction to COVID paired with just an individualistic society where workout rooms go to more small footprint, where it almost has a co-working feel to a fitness facility?
You know, that's interesting. Potentially, yes. People don't want smaller gyms. They want bigger gyms. And it's because, in my opinion, in general, we're not putting the right stuff in there to begin with. And I think people need more space, like I said before, to kind of do their own thing within the gym, because they're not going to lift weights in their apartment if they're considerate. And, you know, they want to be in a social environment. So I don't see gyms getting smaller at all. I see more open space and smarter equipment choices.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Sue, what we're hearing is a really intentional focus on the end user through your surveys and hearing direct feedback from them. And then we know you're on, for instance, the Multifamily Innovation Conference Advisory Board. You know, you're attending South by Southwest. So you're looking outside and inside your industry, talking to your residents. In addition to the trend that you just gave us with fitness and how that is changing, what other trends should multifamily owners be thinking about to skate to where the puck is going to be?
It's all about access solutions right now. It's a delivery-driven economy right now. And people want their stuff to come up to their door. And they don't want to go down and get anyone. They want to be in their pajamas and they want somebody to bring their stuff up to the door. And that came out loud and clear in the COVID surveys that we did. Just get somebody up to their door. So it's going to be about access solutions. It's going to be about how easy it is to not only get somebody to their door, but only get somebody to their door and not the rest of the building. So it goes to, okay, you have to get them into the building. You have to get them into the elevator and you have to make sure that person can only get out at the floor that they're going to and not out in the building in general. So there's a lot of sophisticated and very exciting evolving software related to that. But there's also a lot of players in that space right now. So weeding through that is very challenging. But it's going to be all about access in and out.
Sue, if it's any indication, Abby, who is our brand and marketing manager and also our rock star producer of this podcast, was both nodding her head in agreement as you talked about access. She is an apartment dweller, and it was interesting to see her reaction to those trends.
One of the unfortunate things about our industry right now is that property managers are driving a lot of these decisions about what innovations are made or not made. And again, I'm speaking from experience, so I'm not trying to throw shade on people, but when you are on site every day, the recommendations that you are naturally going to make are the ones that make your life easier, not necessarily the ones that best serve the residents. And so that is my biggest challenge right now in making anything that requires an operational change.
And Sue, the meta issue on there is just one that we would love you to riff on, especially you have a unique experience in an executive role of sitting in the seat of a leasing professional and then sitting in a seat of a property manager. And we'd love that dynamic of everything that the property manager is asked to do and then your key mission of driving resident experience. Any other thoughts that you would have on how property management can either be enabled or solutions around really maybe an important part of their job, which is driving resident experience, but one that they might not have the allocation of time for or the staffing for?
We don't have a good analysis about what people are spending their time doing. But I can tell you what they're not doing. They're not posting rent checks because 90% of rent payments are online. They are not paying bills because they have been centralized in their corporate offices. So my question is, why don't you have time to take somebody's package? I don't think that we have good data other than what the management companies give us about why they're so dang busy. Because I can tell you on most of our deals, the traffic numbers are 7 to 10 pieces of traffic a week, and there are a minimum of 3 people in the office to take that traffic. So one person a day comes through to tour, and there's 3 people to handle it. What's going on? I don't know. And so I think that the answer here is I'd just like to see more equity and ownership groups pushing back, asking questions about what are you really doing? Why are you so busy? And is it because you're inconvenienced and it's no fun to take packages? Or do you really not have the capacity? So I just feel like it's a decades long problem. No matter what happens, you somehow miraculously can never reduce staffing. Why is that? That's kind of a rhetorical question.
Yeah, no, I think I remember having a conversation with you in Phoenix, Sue, when we were looking at some deals together, and you had mentioned kind of how the technology pitch is often that it will reduce headcount, but it never happens, right? Like, or make staffing more efficient. Maybe reduce headcount's not the right word. But I think that if we can go off the script for a second here, I'm sure you'd love that. I think that it would be really interesting, just like off the cuff, if you have three people on site and you can give them any responsibility, how would you build your team to operate one of these assets?
Oh my God. I literally have chills. Like, I'm going to get emotional. Like, nobody's ever asked me this, and I know the answer. Okay. So it's three people in the leasing office. So the manager, to me, is going to be walking the corridors and the amenity spaces on a daily basis, and then requiring the maintenance staff to maintain them. That's first and foremost. The second thing is, I would like to have a team where all three of them are articulate and can send out resident correspondence, because residents want engagement. They want to know what's going on. They would like to know how to meet their neighbors. They would like to have events. We have so many requests for events. Another person would not necessarily plan the events, but would understand how to coordinate multiple vendors and participants to create great events. Somebody who's a good resource coordinator. Obviously, somebody's going to have to lease an apartment, but what I would like that person to do is not just go in an apartment, but actually be familiar with the features in that apartment and them out. That seems like leasing 101, and it isn't. We had a focus group. We had residents say, we didn't even know this rooftop lounge existed. So I feel like if you have somebody who is dedicated to making sure that the property is maintained, seems simple, but that requires being out of the office and walking around and coordinating your maintenance stuff, an entire team that has the good judgment to put out appropriate messaging to the residents, a good leasing person who is familiar with all of the benefits of the property and knows to point them out, and then people who are nice. So I'd like to have a staff that brings it all together. I love the staff. Not only are they great, but my corridors are pristine all the time and they actually answer my phone calls. It's really not that hard. That's what I'd like to see.
Do you think that is part of the challenge of that shift? I love this overview. It's super educational for me and Trevor. But given that a lot of the progression is through leasing and kind of moving up to property management, it seems like skill set wise, we're looking for something different than just a leasing agent who has growth ability, right? It's you're looking for someone who's attentive to details, walking the corridor, kind of in the minutia of an asset, right? Talking about the manager, being able to communicate that to the maintenance staff, and then a resource coordinator, which a great resource coordinator might be terrible at leasing potentially, right? Like so it's kind of interesting just thinking about if we did restructure, if the management industry did shift. It seems like the type of person that the playing field kind of opens up on what that trio could look like.
Well, and to keep in mind that I think that is more of a stabilized scenario, because during lease up, it's just everybody just needs to lease apartments. And the excitement of a new project and the fact that there's really nothing to be made ready, like the maintenance aspect is next to nothing, at least for the first 6 months. So the lease up, because nothing gets dirty, there's nobody living there. It's just easier. And so it's easier to focus on the sale. But when you are stabilized, it just is a whole new ball of wax because you don't want people to move out. You need people to stay there. Right now, I mean, it's just a really competitive environment. People leave constantly for the next best opportunity or the next best, you know, highest salary. But I feel like if you really play to someone's skills, they'll just flourish in that role, and pay somebody for being a great resource manager, not just for being able to be a good manager. Like, you know, there's just a very traditional aspirational ladder right now that I feel needs to be broken before we can reset.
That's excellent too. And speaking of right now, we're obviously, for those listening, we're in September of 2020. So we're 6 months into a global pandemic, that I think we've had this discussion before, Sue, and it's Riley and I's contention that a lot of the trends that we were believing in and seeing in multifamily, in many cases, COVID-19 accelerated those trends. But would love to kind of hear what you're seeing from your executive role and obviously focus on resident experience. What are the key impacts of the pandemic to the asset class that you're focused on and to resident experience?
Well, we mentioned packages, so I won't go back to that topic, but for obvious reasons, that's just accelerated. But outdoor amenities, while always important, those in patios and balconies, they're just going to be even more important. And in fact, we just placed in one of our Denver deals an outdoor co-working space so that people can get out of their apartment. I mean, just anecdotally speaking, you know, this time has made a lot of people realize what's important. And a lot of people, like, for example, are cooking. And so, you know, ensuring that we have counter space and cabinet space is going to be even more important. There's a perception that millennials don't cook, and that is so far from the truth. Millennials and Gen Zs are very concerned with health and healthy food and organics, and therefore they actually do cook a lot. So paying attention to that, and outdoor spaces, co-working space is going to be a big deal. And then I think we're going to be seeing, and certainly in our deals, you'll be seeing more like crafting hobby spaces where people can come together and make stuff, whether it's painting or borrowing tools or whatever that looks like. That's big right now. And I don't really see that stopping. I also want to put in one other observation I've made, and that is a popular misconception, and that is that young people do not like to be with others because they're so used to being on their phones and in social media, and that is not true. It's almost that people value human interaction even more so, but on a quality level. So what are you doing when you get together that you can't do just texting on your phone, right? So a lot of the texting is planning what to go out and do. And so really having an ear to how to make a community out of your project, I think is going to be really key on many levels, and how to bring people together safely in groups.
That is excellent insight. You know, one thing that we have been thinking about is that the home becomes more important, and your mention of cooking, outside spaces, places for people to work, places for people to make things, and then places where people can both have and be in community. If those are all under the heading of the importance of home, and could not agree more that they become increasingly important in this post-pandemic era. So we are at the end of our interview, which means we're in the placemaking final four. So this is fun for us because we get to ask each of our guests four questions and hear kind of their answers across multiple episodes. And so I'll start off with the first of the final four, which is, what is one book you recommend most to your friends and colleagues?
This is going to be unexpected. There is one book that I read, and I read it when I was with CWS, and it changed my life as a female executive, and it's called Hardball for Women. And I recommend it to every woman in the industry because, still applies now, men and women are different, and nobody wants to acknowledge that, but they are. And women are more collaborative in the workplace in general, and men are more hierarchical. And once you understand that, it's a game changer. And the way that you guys, that you know how I communicate right now, that is because of this book. And I learned, at just as an example, when you're talking in a male-dominated environment, say your point first. And if anybody wants to know how you got to it, they'll ask. Otherwise, be quiet. And that has been a game changer for me. As much as you guys let me talk, normally in a business environment, like in a business meeting, I just say what I think we should do, and then I shut up. And then a lot of times, nothing else has to come from it. So it's those little things. It was, again, I can't say enough about it. So for all you ladies out there listening, it's a game changer. It's a great how-to.
Yeah, that's awesome, Sue. There's a lot of strength and power in that. I feel like I've been in conversations with you where you say something and I almost want to ask you why, but then I'm too intimidated to ask. And so
I
just kind of ask.
I don't mean to shut people down. If you have a question, ask, but it's like.
I was praising a trait in you. I was a trait. Awesome. Okay. So what's one place that inspires you?
Just nature. So I, for various reasons, I like the beach or the mountains. And I find as a human that being out there and disconnecting and just quieting the noise, it results in actual inspiration to go forward and do something that you haven't thought of before, just because you're quieting down and you're seeing yourself as part of a bigger picture and part of just, kind of how small we are, kind of cliche, but that's what inspires me. Like, especially COVID has been great for that. I'll just go out for a drive, or I've been camping a lot or whatever. And it's actually been a really incredible experience for me as a result. So
that's awesome. Sue, what's one hope that you have for the multifamily industry?
More open-mindedness and flexibility. Just the ability it's not a lack of desire, but just the ability to act on something that makes sense without too much fear. Just trying things is what I would hope for us, is that we just try more things.
That's excellent. So this is our favorite question. We ask it at the end of every podcast. What are you grateful for?
I think that I am most grateful for, I'll just say professionally, just an environment where I have been able to just freaking take not only my skills, but what I love, and have so much freedom to apply those things and the support to try new things. TCR, absolutely, one of our core values is to be a leader in product design and technology. And we're putting, our money where our mouth is. And so I'm super grateful for that. And to be a part of that.
Well, we are too, and we can attest to that, Sue. Sue Vickery is independent, competitive, innovative, but what we heard today is she has a clear passion and years of experience in multiple different parts of the industry to make better multifamily places. The residents and stakeholders of TCR are the beneficiaries. Sue, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for asking me to do this. You know how I love talking about our industry, and I am super passionate. So it's been fun. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks so much, too.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining today's show. We're so grateful for the opportunity to learn together. The best way to stay connected to us is to visit our website at craftworkgroup.com/realestateclients. There you'll be able to view our show notes and learn more about how we create better places through the Craftwork Hospitality Company.
This episode of Placemaking was valuable to you. Please share it with your friends and colleagues. If you liked what you heard, give us 5 stars. And if you don't, I guess you can give us 4. Special thanks to our guests today and to Abby Nivens, our producer of the Placemaking podcast. She's a rock star. Until next time, keep being purposeful in the places you make.